Views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
This show's audio was via a Skype call.
Welcome to Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek. Marge was searching for the purpose of her life and the truth that would tie everything together to make sense of what was taught and what was happening on our planet, the fire that was creating all the smoke. Through many experiences, she was finally led to the Knowledge Book that provided all the answers. Marge is now talking about this gift to humanity on Knowledge Book Radio, so all can be united in peace, love, and harmony. This live call-in show at 1-800-930-2819 is amazing. So get ready to hear about the Knowledge Book. Here's your host, Marge Potasek.
Hello, everyone. I'm Marge Potasek, and you are listening to the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek on Transformation Talk Radio. For the next hour, as we have been continuing to do for over a year now, I guess, we'll cover some topics about the Knowledge Book, connected to the Knowledge Book, and from the Knowledge Book. And this week, we are going to talk about alchemy. But before we go on, let me remind you that our website is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. Again, www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. The Turkish website is www.dkbdavidkiteboy-mevlana.org.tr. And my telephone number for suggestions on topics to cover, questions you may have, any kind of comments you may have, is 973-787-7035. Again, 973-787-7035. And my email address is mmjp99, marymaryjohnpeter99@gmail.com. So please do text or email me with any questions or suggestions that arise from this topic or previous shows. And eventually, if you have enough questions, we will compile them and present them, the answers to the questions further on in time. Okay, and now what we're going to do is talk about alchemy. We've all heard some stories about alchemy and maybe some history. And for me personally, alchemy had always been this topic of transmuting, changing gold, lead into gold. So as we know, lead is a metal that absorbs radiation. When we go to a doctor's office, for us not to be able to absorb the x-rays that are being given to us in a certain part of the body, the rest of the body is covered with a sheet of lead so that that energy that is not supposed to go to that part of the body doesn't go there, and we are protected. So this is something that absorbs energies and doesn't let anything through. And we are supposed to be connecting and changing this lead that absorbs energy and does not let anything through into something that's gold. And gold, of course, is a perfect transmitter. Whatever energies it receives, it is able to transmit. It is used in cell phones, it is used in telephones and communication devices because it is such a good conductor. So what is alchemy? And alchemy is described as a philosophical and proto-scientific tradition. And this was practiced throughout Asia, Africa, and Europe. It aimed to purify, mature, and perfect certain objects, and that includes humans. And in all these regions, the common objectives of alchemy were chrysopoeia, or the transmutation of base metals like gold into noble metals, particularly gold, and the creation of an elixir of immortality. I don't know if I said this correctly. It's base metals like lead into noble metals like gold. And the creation of an elixir of immortality. It also aimed to create a compound, an elixir, to be able to cure any disease and therefore allow the human to have immortality. And they also tried to develop an alkahest or a universal solvent that could dissolve any substance, including gold. Now, if you know, gold is something that does not get corroded at all. Even acid does not corrode gold. So the perfection of the human body and soul was thought to permit or result from the alchemical magnum opus and, in the Hellenistic and Western tradition, the ultimate aim was the achievement of gnosis, or spiritual, total spiritual knowledge. Now, in Europe, the creation of a philosopher's stone was variously connected to all these projects. And the philosopher's stone itself is a symbol of the mystical terminology of alchemy, and it symbolized perfection at its finest, enlightenment and heavenly bliss. To continue on with the description of alchemy, so in the English writings, the term itself is limited to descriptions of European alchemy. However, similar practices also existed in the Far East, the Indian subcontinent, and in the Muslim world. And in the Europe, following the 12th century, Renaissance produced by the translation of Islamic works on science and the recovery of Aristotle, alchemists played a very significant role in early modern science, the development of early modern science, especially in chemistry and medicine. Both Islamic and European alchemists developed a structure of basic laboratory techniques, of theory, of terminology, and experimental method, and some of which we are still using today. However, they continued the old beliefs of only having four elements, and they kept their work secret. They used ciphers and cryptic symbolism to hide what their work is, so only the internal people, the people who knew what those symbols meant and what the ciphers meant, were able to understand and communicate with each other. And this work all was guided by hermetic principles that were related to magic, mythology, and religion. So this in itself is a far cry from the current science, but however, it still built the basis of science. So again, modern discussions of alchemy are split into two, or generally split into two. One is the examination of its exoteric, meaning public, practical applications, and the other is the esoteric or spiritual aspects. So those who were interested in the exoteric applications were the historians, and they examined the physical sciences. And their approach to the subject was through the fields of chemistry, medicine, and charlatanism. And how the philosophy and the religious context of that time was going on at the time that, you know, the science and chemistry and medicine were being developed. Now, the esoteric aspect, again, was being promulgated and became the interest of historians of esotericism, of psychologists, and some philosophers and spiritualists. The subject also made an ongoing impact on literature and arts. However, based and according to scholars like Holmyard and von Franz, They thought that these two aspects, both the public and the hidden, the secret, should be viewed as being connected to and complementary to each other and not be mutually exclusive. However, this separation happened because, according to von Franz, was when Greek philosophy was mixed with Egyptian and Mesopotamian technology. However, since then, many sources have stressed an integration of esoteric and exoteric approaches to alchemy going back to the first century AD. So we're going quite a way back. Now, it may surprise some of you, and it did surprise actually me as well, is that the greatest alchemist in history was Sir Isaac Newton. Now, he is the gentleman who is credited with the discovery of gravity, number one, the laws of motion, number two, and calculus, number three. So he's, of course, one of the most widely recognized scientists of all time and was a key figure in the scientific revolution. He published a book called The Philosophic Naturalis Principia Mathematica, first published in 1687, and this is the book that laid the foundations for classical mechanics. And he made seminal contributions to optics, and he shares credit with Gottfried Leibniz for the development of calculus, of course. Newton's Principia, this book that he published, put together the laws of motion and universal gravitation. And this theory, this philosophy, was the governing principle that governed scientists' views of the physical universe for the next three centuries and beyond. It is still practiced, however, on a certain level. This is only mechanical. This is classical theory of motion. Now, Newton was able to derive, based on his calculations, based on his theory of motion and how things work with each other, he was able to arrive at the Kepler's law of planetary motion. And he again used the same principles to account for the trajectories of comets, the tides, the precession of the equinoxes, and other phenomena. Newton removed the last doubts about the validity of the heliocentric model of the solar system and demonstrated that the motion of objects on Earth and of celestial bodies could be accounted for by the same principle. So basically, his was the defining mathematical construct that told us that the sun was the center of our universe and the planets revolved around the sun and not that everything revolved around the Earth. However, what is little known about him is that he dedicated a lot of his time to the study of alchemy and biblical chronology. But we didn't know much about his work because these were published a very long time after his death. And actually, calculus and all these laws that he came up with, all these mathematical constructs he came up with, was the result of his dabblings and his search for the Philosopher's Stone, for that principle of transmutation of base metals into a noble metal. Now, one of the best-kept secrets in the history of science was in Isaac Newton's handwritten manuscripts. He actually described the recipe for the Philosopher's Stone, which is a legendary substance that has the reputation of being able to turn base metals like iron and lead into gold. Now Newton's dabblings in alchemy are well known, but his belief that he had found a closely guarded blueprint for the Philosopher's Stone was very surprising, at least surprised everyone who actually read those manuscripts that he had left. But Newton was not the only intellectual heavyweight from his era trying to make gold. The recipe for the Philosopher's Stone had come from his older contemporary, and this was the famous chemist, Robert Boyle, who was a devotee of alchemy. Now, I'm going to read a quote from Robert Boyle. And actually, sometimes it may feel that when we're reading the knowledge book that this applies to us as well. So the quote is, diverse of hermetic books have such involved obscurities that they may justly be compared to riddles written in ciphers. For after a man has surmounted the difficulty of deciphering the words and terms, he finds a new and greater difficulty to discover the meaning of the seemingly plain expression. So sometimes when I'm reading the knowledge book, even though it is written in English and I understand English, however, the actual meaning of those words that I'm reading is a bit lost to me. I haven't been able to, at some point in time, to be able to make connections between one part of the book and the other part of the book to actually understand everything in the book. Now, alchemy on another level was a valuable and necessary phase in the development of modern chemistry. What was able to accomplish, or maybe as an offshoot of what the alchemists produced, was the ability to create new alloys. They were able to manufacture acids and pigments. They invented the distillation process, and this is used now in making perfumes and whiskeys. They're the ones that thought of atoms as centuries before we produced the modern atomic theory. And they also gave a template. They produced a template for scientific method by running controlled experiments again and again. So according to this one idea, the alchemists were not misguided, but they were misinformed, and they tried to make best sense of the world they couldn't see. And they understood a lot, and the fact that they did understand so much is the real miracle here. And though sometimes people think that alchemy is a witchcraft, those alchemists were in fact laying the foundations of modern experimental science. Now, the history of alchemy goes back to ancient Egypt. And the start of alchemy is a document called the Emerald Tablets. This Emerald Tablet, also known as Smaragdine Table or Tabula Smaragdina, is a compact and cryptic piece of Hermetica reputed to contain the secret of the prima materia and its transmutation. It was highly regarded by European alchemists as the foundation of their art and its Hermetic tradition. The original source of the Emerald Tablet is unknown, although Hermes Trismegistus, otherwise known as Thoth, is the author named in the text. Its first known appearance is in a book written in Arabic between the 6th and 8th centuries. The text was first translated into Latin in the 12th century. Numerous translations, interpretations, and commentaries followed. Now, the layers of meaning in the Emerald Tablet have been associated with the creation of the Philosopher's Stone in laboratory experimentation, phase transition, and alchemical magnum opus, the classical element system, and the correspondence between macrocosm and microcosm. Now, the Emerald Tablets themselves consist of 13 to 15 tablets, each of them containing some history and some writings. And the way this book was written is similar to what the Knowledge Book does, in that the book was written to target certain consciousness levels. And as the person was reading the Emerald Tablets gave to that reader that knowledge that was open to that level of consciousness of the reader. So you may find that this is very familiar in the way that the writing was done and how it was being used to transmit knowledge to those who read them. Now, the actual alchemical timeline is as follows. First of all, the Egyptians first started alchemy with the Emerald Tablets. However, as Egyptians produced and went onward, eventually this Egyptian alchemy disappears. Okay, then comes Chinese. They begin to practice alchemy. Then this alchemist Zheng Kunliang discovers gunpowder. That's one side shoot of the alchemical process. Then, of course, alchemy spread to Europe when the Spaniards learned about alchemy from the monks. So again, it's from Asia, probably Tibet. Then Renaissance started. After the Renaissance, alchemy then is banned in China. Then the European alchemist Nicolas Flamel creates a philosopher's stone. then somehow Nicholas disappears, and the formula for the Philosopher's Stones disappears with him. Then the Renaissance ends, and eventually arrive at today, where alchemy by itself is not particularly studied, or at least not publicly. The Egyptian and Greek alchemy. So under the Egyptians, most of the alchemical techniques were still very much under the subject, under the heading of art and not science. And the ones who practiced alchemy were the priests. Now, these priests meticulously documented their sources. They also experimented and developed new methods. However, these methods were connected closely to the Egyptian gods, especially Imhotep and other divine provenance. So ancient Egyptian alchemy used some refined chemical techniques, and their knowledge was taken and used by the Greeks. In fact, the Egyptians were so skilled that the Greeks made new practical contributions to the history of chemistry. They instead concentrated upon rationalism and developing new theories. So they took whatever the Egyptians gave and whatever Egyptians had and just basically superimposed and used that knowledge in more practical ways. Now, Leucippus, born between and around 460 BC, was one of the first philosophers to propose the existence of atoms as indivisible units of matter, and his pupil Democritus expanded on this idea. Now, there was some evidence that the ancient Indian philosophers also had this inspiration at the same time. However, their ideas were surrounded by elegant terms of Vedic thought and Eastern spirituality. However, this idea of the atom was basically crushed by Aristotle, otherwise known as the father of science. So he actually set the field of chemistry back by many centuries because he superimposed and he held firm to the idea that there are only four elements. Aristotle and Plato before him found the views of Democritus bordered on blasphemy. In other words, it was anti-religion. It was something that is not supposed to be stated, that matter consists of atoms and not of the four elements. Now, Democritus proposed that atoms also govern thoughts and reasoning. And this was the very first glimmer of materialist philosophy, which again was anathema to the greatest philosophers who believed in a divine will. In opposition to the theory of the atom being the basic building block of matter, again, Aristotle believed that all compounds were made of varying amounts of four elements of earth, fire, air, and water, and that they conferred various attributes to materials. In turn, each of these elements was made up of a combination of opposite attributes, wet and dry, hot and cold, etc. I mean, this theory was to pervade Islamic and medieval alchemy for centuries, overriding the postulations of the atomists. In addition, Aristotle's implications that compounds were not permanent and could be changed fueled the quest for the Philosopher's Stone to convert base metals into gold. This belief was so prevalent in the classical world that the Roman Emperor Diocletian allegedly burnt papyri in Egypt to prevent priests and rulers from uncovering the secret and becoming wealthy enough to threaten the Roman Empire. Now, in the West, Western alchemy may generally be traced to ancient and Hellenistic Egypt, with the city of Alexandria being the center of alchemical knowledge. It retained its preeminence through most of the Greek and Roman periods. Elements of technology, religion, mythology, and Hellenistic philosophy, each with their own much longer histories, combined to form the earliest known records of alchemy in the West. Zosimos of Panopolis wrote the oldest known books on alchemy, while Mary the Jewess is credited with being the first non-fictitious Western alchemist. They wrote in Greek and lived in Egypt under Roman rule. Now, there was a woman called Cleopatra the Alchemist, and she probably lived in the 3rd century BC, and she was a Greek Egyptian alchemist. She was an author and a philosopher of Ptolemaic Egypt. She experimented with practical alchemy, but is also credited as one of the four female alchemists that could produce the philosopher's stone. And she is considered to be the inventor of the alembic, an early tool for analytic chemistry. The dates of Cleopatra and the alchemist's life and death are unknown, but she was active in Alexandria in the 3rd century or the 4th century BCE. She is associated with the school of alchemy typified by Mary the Jewess and Comarius. These alchemists used complex apparatus for distillation and sublimation. Now, technology. The dawn of Western alchemy is sometimes associated with that of metallurgy, extending back to 3500 BC. Many writings were lost when the Emperor Diocletian ordered the burning of alchemical books after suppressing a revolt in Alexandria. This was in AD 292. Few original Egyptian documents on alchemy have survived, most notable among them the Stockholm Papyrus and the Leyden Papyrus X. Dating from AD 300 to 500, they contained recipes for dyeing of imitation gold and silver. These writings don't go into the mystical areas. However, they dived into making artificial gemstones, cleaning and fabricating pearls, and manufacturing philosophical elements of chemical. They also contain the work of Bolus of Mendes, or Pseudo-Democritus, which aligned these recipes with theoretical knowledge of astrology and the classical elements. Now, there are changes that took place around this time that transformed metallurgy into a hermetic art. In other words, we went from metallurgy to, again, alchemy and the art field. Now, in India, the Vedas themselves describe a connection between eternal life and gold. And they use mercury for alchemy in the 3rd or 4th century. Now, the Buddhist texts also, from the 2nd to the 5th centuries, mention transmutation of base metals to gold. Greek alchemy may have been introduced to ancient India through the invasions of Alexander the Great in 325 BC, and kingdoms that were culturally influenced by the Greeks, like Gandhara, although hard evidence for this is not found. Now, in the 11th century, there was a Persian chemist and physician called Abu Rayhan Biruni, who visited Gujarat as part of the court of Mahmud the Ghazni, reported that they have a science similar to alchemy, which is quite peculiar to them, which in Sanskrit is called Rasayana, and in Persian, Rasavatam. It means the art of obtaining, manipulating rasa, nectar, mercury, or juice. This art was restricted to certain operations, metals, drugs, compounds, and medicines, many of which have mercury as their core element. Its principles restored the health of those who were ill, beyond hope, and gave back youth to fading old age. In India, the goals of alchemy included the creation of a divine body and immortality while still being embodied. Sanskrit alchemical texts include much material on the manipulation of mercury and sulfur that are homologized with the semen of the god Shiva and the menstrual blood of the goddess Devi. Two famous early Indian alchemical authors were Nagarjuna Siddha and Natyanatha Siddha. Nagarjuna Siddha was a Buddhist monk. His book, Rasendramanalgamalgalam, is an example of Indian alchemy and medicine. Nityanatha Siddha wrote Rasaratnakara, also a highly influential work. In Sanskrit, rasa means translates to mercury, and Nagarjuna Siddha was said to have developed a method of converting mercury into gold. A great deal remains to be discovered about Indian alchemical literature. The content of the Sanskrit alchemical corpus has not yet been adequately integrated into wider general history or alchemy. Now we could delve into the late and modern alchemy. The rise of modern science, with its emphasis on rigorous quantitative experimentation and its disdain for ancient wisdom, brought about the downfall of alchemy. Although the seeds of these events were planted as early as the 17th century, alchemy still flourished for some 200 years and, in fact, may have reached its peak in the 18th century. As late as 1781, James Price claimed to have produced a powder that could transmute mercury into silver or gold. Early modern European alchemy continued to exhibit a diversity of theories, practices, and purposes. Scholastic and anti-Aristotelian, Periclesian and anti-Periclesian, Hermetic, Neoplatonic, Mechanistic, Vitalistic, and more, plus virtually every combination and compromise thereof. Now again, Robert Boyle and the scientific method. He himself lived from 1627 to 1691. He was the one that pioneered the scientific method in chemical investigations. He assumed nothing at all in his experiments and compiled every piece of relevant data. He was so meticulous, he would note the place in which the experiment was carried out, the wind characteristics, the position of the sun and the moon, and the barometer reading, all just in case they proved to be relevant. This approach eventually led to the founding of modern chemistry in the 18th and 19th centuries, based on revolutionary discoveries of Lavoisier and Dalton. Now, coming to today, beginning with around 1720, a rigid distinction was drawn between alchemy and chemistry for the first time. By the 1740s, alchemy was now restricted to the realm of gold making, leading to the popular belief that alchemists were charlatans, and the tradition itself nothing more than a fraud. In order to protect the developing science of modern chemistry from the negative censure to which alchemy was being subjected, academic writers during the Scientific Enlightenment attempted, for the sake of survival, to separate and divorce the new chemistry from the old practices of alchemy. This move was mostly successful, with chemistry now being accepted as the science of the 19th and 20th century and to the present day. Now, humanity's quest. From its inception, humanity has been in a continuous quest, a search for a way to transmute, to change, to produce something precious from the base and ordinary, and for a magic potion, an elixir that would allow humans to be healthy and live forever. During this search, we've stumbled upon findings that have brought us from not understanding much about the world and everything in it to our scientific discoveries of how the physical realm works, and the discovery of what lies beyond. Maybe the first technology was that bequeathed by Thoth, the Atlantean, prescribed in the Emerald Tablets dated at around 36,000 BC. The Emerald Tablets are the basis of what we know as alchemy today. In reviewing some of the information that exists about these tablets, the technology seems to work in the same way that the sacred books and the knowledge book works. Depending on the thoughts of the reader, the text provides knowledge and understanding reacting to and based on those thoughts of the reader. So alchemy arose as a discipline and a quest to find the technology to achieve the goals of transmutation, transformation, and metamorphosis into something more perfect than what currently existed. At each step of the evolution of humanity, starting from its initial success in achieving the human form, we were given the technology, the means whereby we could gradually achieve our dream of immortality. However, we could not grasp, could not comprehend, and therefore could not fully utilize the methodology we were given. We failed to understand that nothing is done immediately, that achieving immortality was a gradual process, since the body exists in a very limited range of energy and, although it can mutate and adapt to different conditions, it can only do this gradually. During the time of the Far East philosophies, the technology was the meditation technique and all the formal practices associated with it. This technology, followed exactly as prescribed by the guru, allowed the human to achieve nirvana, the perfected body and immortality. The sacred texts prescribing certain combinations of mantras, herbs, and metals were the elixir to change the physical bodies, allowing them to undergo the very rigorous and strenuous physical practices given. However, for various reasons, not all humans were able to utilize this method. Following this path, high Tibetan monks have been known to go through walls, leave foot and hand imprints in stone, levitate, know the past and the future, know their past lives, and know what their future is, and also to be able to control death and their incarnation process. The next technology was the Kabbalah of Moses and the technology of obeying the law. However, even those who had promised to help Moses rejected the given methodology. Those who accepted and utilized them and Moses' lineage were saved. This program is still currently in effect. Those who fully accept and persevere on the knowledge book path design will succeed in going to the advanced dimensions to join our elder brothers, and that individual's families will be accompanying them without having to go through the evolution ladder. Then came the technology of love and the miracles of Jesus Christ. The miracles performed allowed humans to believe and start to incorporate this method in their lives. And finally, the desired effect on humanity was accomplished. This technology is also in effect now. Through the miracles, though, the miracles themselves are on an individual, not on a public basis, as most of those in the knowledge book studies can attest. And through service to humanity, we are putting love into action in every breath, extending this love to all that is. The next technology given was that of the knowledge and logic delivered by Muhammad. And again, the knowledge book emphasizes the use of our intellect, logic, and common sense. Quote, common sense is tantamount to the law of the universe, unquote, continues this program. At each step of our evolution, our process of metamorphosis from human to genuine human, we were given the technological methods perfectly suited to the level of the then existing human. The new technology given both built upon and included the previous technology. We finally arrived at the knowledge book that follows the same educational approach. It builds upon and incorporates all the previous technologies from Moses to Muhammad. And the new technology is that of the light photon cyclone technique, the elixir that treats, evolves, and addresses each person individually based on their thoughts, consciousness, and evolution level. So here have we come full circle to the teachings of Thoth and a return to the golden civilization of Atlanta. The knowledge book says, one day you will come to the end and arrive at the beginning. That's a paraphrase. Okay, so now it looks like it is a good time for a break. So I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasik, and to remind everyone that our website is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. Telephone number for questions for the topics is 973-787-7035. Again, 973-787-7035. When we come back, we will continue with the alchemy that we've been discussing and further clarifications. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
To find answers to life's questions, you need to look within yourself. Dr. Glenna Rice brings your questionable conversations on Transformation Talk Radio each month. Tune in each month for insight into how you can live up to your full potential. Dr. Glenna is a physical therapist, certified Access Consciousness, and Access Body Class Facilitator. How does it get any better than this? For more information on Dr. Glenna Rice and her work, visit glennarice.com.
Gifted intuitive healer and spiritual teacher Sarah Luce brings her unique style to the hit show Small Steps, Big Breakthrough Radio on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Tune in each month as Sarah turns reality on end and shows us how to experience expansive results with simple yet powerful steps. Expect an enlightening bend on what you currently believe is possible. For show details and upcoming topics, visit SarahLuce.com. That's SarahLuce.com.
What is a brilliant culture, and how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough five-step process to help you align your culture with your business strategy for exceptional results. Looking for a culture that drives organizational excellence? Listen to Cultural Brilliance Radio, the second and fourth Friday of each month at 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern on Transformation Talk Radio. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit culturalbrilliance.com.
Our angels and animals are always working for and around us. Darcy Pariso knew from an early age she felt this incredible presence that was confirmed for her in a Reiki Level 1 course. From then on, she has honed her skills and dedicated her talents to providing answers, inspiration, and tools for people to move past limiting blocks and past traumas to truly live a life of happiness. For more information about working with Darcy, visit darcypariso.com.
Take your own journey with the angels with Claire Candy Huff's heaven-sent guided angel meditation CD. Letting go of concerns and living in the now. This beautiful CD walks listeners through practical exercises to help free them from the burdens, worries, and concerns of daily life.
Walking a quarter of the way across the bridge, you see a bright emerald green light and sense a loving presence. This is Archangel Raphael's green healing energies, nourishing and revitalizing you. Take a moment now to bathe in this green healing light.
Giving you much more than just relaxation and stress release, this wonderfully narrated CD provides vivid visualization, soothing and inspiring music, and an angel's choir that will bring you peace, clarity, and a newfound awareness. Visit angelhealinghouse.com today.
And we're back on the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek on Transformation Talk Radio. Again, the reminder for information about the studies and more details about the writing program and generally about the studies like the focal point, it can be found on our website, which is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. Telephone number for texting, either questions or comments or topics to be covered on the show is 973-787-7035, and the email address is mmjp99marymaryjohnpeter99@gmail.com. And now we'll continue with the topic of alchemy. Alchemy generally is considered to be something that is done to transform, transmute, and change something that is baser into something that is more precious and more noble. So we're going from base to noble, to nobility. And a lot of times the noble is represented by gold. And when you think of gold, everyone wants to have gold. The money standard is gold. Beautiful jewelry is gold. Gold is also used in cell phones and communication devices because it is able to transmit the signals it's coming coming into the device as cleanly and clearly to the other end. In other words, a perfect communication device. Now, in its quest, because we were looking for the formula to be able to do this on our own, we missed the boat. We missed the boat in the sense that we were given this technology. We were given how this is to be accomplished and how it can be accomplished, how we can achieve immortal life, how we can achieve perfect health, how we can achieve having everything perfect. However, we missed the boat because we couldn't quite understand what was being given to us and how it was given to us. However, in the meantime, because of our search for this elixir, for this fountain of youth, for this immortality of transmutation, not only of our bodies, but our spirits into something much more noble and perfect and closer to God, we've stumbled upon chemistry, we've stumbled upon the atomic method, the scientific method. We've discovered the law of gravity. We've discovered how planets work. We discovered that the sun does not circulate around the Earth, but the Earth circulates around the sun, that all the planets go around the sun. They had very, very complicated drawings and methodologies where they were trying to figure out how all the planets, how they appear to revolve around us, what kind of shells they had to be in, and how these shells moved in relation to each other to be able to produce the known results or the known what we see in the night sky. However, when Newton came in, and again, trying to achieve the Philosopher's Stone, trying to achieve this ability to transmute lead into gold, and human to give humans immortality and perfect health, he arrived at the laws of motion, at calculus, at being able to put into a formula the law by which, when it is put down simply and easily, everything falls into place without complications, without any kind of crazy stuff going on, to be able to represent and predict what the motion of the stars would be and the motion of the planets would be. So we stumbled upon physical means of expressing what's going on around us and how the physical realm around us is actually produced and maintained. And we've been able to develop our minds, and we were able to develop everything till we got to the point now where we can go to Mars, we can go to the moon, we can send messengers out in space to see what the further reaches of the universe are. However, we still seem to be missing this basic concept, this basic idea that we were given the technology, except we didn't recognize this technology. And we are still being given technology, and we still don't understand, we still don't want to follow the technology that is being given to us. So at every step of the game, starting with the Emerald Tablets that were given by Tote, and starting with the knowledge that came to the Far East, and again through meditation, and the formulas that were arrived at. Now, the Tibetan texts apparently are the closest to the original texts that were given to humans. And by following those texts, so the process of Tibetan Buddhism, the process is you have to know the Tibetan language. You need to be able to recite those prayers in Tibetan, because it is in Tibetan that those energies and frequencies can come into you. And those prayers, those practices, each one of them are specifically designed and specifically given to give that individual who is reciting them, who is doing that practice, those energies and frequencies that practice gives and is designed to deliver. And by going step by step through a very rigorous process of one practice building on another practice, building on another practice, we are able to then evolve and purify and become closer and closer to what to that perfect human, what the Tibetans call the rainbow body and immortality. I mean, there are stories of monks living for 200, 300 years when they are actually following the prescription given in the Tibetan texts. So that program, of course, didn't work quite well on us because we weren't able to follow that kind of a practice rigorously. So in came Moses, and again, the same thing happened. Those that followed the Kabbalah, those that were able to accomplish the practices prescribed by the Kabbalah, and those who were in Moses' lineage, meaning his family, we're able to go to the next level. We're able to go to the next step. Okay? Now, the next level of the technology that was given to humans was the technology of love, of being able to love each other, forgive each other, and be able to look the other way. If someone hurt you, that's okay. You don't have to hurt them back. If somebody slaps you, that's okay too. You don't have to slap them back. So it's the love and forgiveness that allowed that to work. And love itself was the miracle that transformed humans and is still transforming humans today. And of course, besides love, we also need knowledge. That's where Muhammad came in with the Quran. And then Mevlana came in with the Mesnevi. And each of these technologies, each of these methods was a particular way of allowing that human who followed those methods to be able to incorporate the energies and frequencies that method was able to deliver. And step by step, we're able to go further and further up the evolutionary level. And then comes, of course, the knowledge book. And this is a very special technology. This is a technology that is being delivered by the light photon cyclone technique. And where before we were what the knowledge book calls in the up-pointing triangle, where we are being given, we are given grace, we are given help, we are given energies, we are given frequencies, and we have beings called angels that are helping us. We are now in the up-down pointing triangle, and this is the place where we learn through opposites, that we learn through the opposite of what is going on. In other words, it is the hard, it is not the good time that will be teaching us, it is the hard time that we're having that will be teaching us. And it may not be surprising to many of you, but whatever still impurities we have in us that we have not been able to get rid of up to this time, in other words, those previous energies that we were given, the previous frequencies that we were given, were not able to fully purify us. So we're now in the next process of purification. We're now in the upside down triangle. And that means what the knowledge book calls driving a nail out with another nail. Meaning, and I have an example of this, at one point in time, I was in Istanbul and someone said something to me and I got very emotional about it. I got really hurt. So I came to my eyes. I was very hurt. And one of the solar teachers in Istanbul who noticed this said the expression, to drive out a nail by another nail. And I asked, what does that actually mean? And she said, well, you still have emotions that need to be cleansed, that need to be cleared. So that woman who said that to you, basically that was used to drive that emotion out of you, to bring it to the fore, and for you to be able to clear it, for you to be able to eliminate it. So whatever please expect that whatever button you still have that has not been pushed, that has not been cleared, that has not been processed, will be pushed. We need to clarify, we need to release everything that has to be released that we still have to deal with. So if you're still in fear, then you will be put in situations where you will be afraid until you learn to know and explore what that fear is, why you are afraid, and learn that, okay, it's dark. You're afraid in the dark. However, there is a process by which you could turn the light on, know what's going on, and know what is happening. And when you know what is happening and how it is happening, then you're comfortable with it and you're no longer afraid. If you still have anger inside, if you still have anger issues, then you will be put into situations where people will be angry at you. Okay, so we still need to go through step-by-step purification process to allow us to go through and finish up the purification. And in this way, we ourselves become the gold. We ourselves become perfect transmitters of the energies and frequencies coming in. So we are now in a period where we are all becoming mediums. We are able to know, most of us, who's going to be calling us or when a telephone rings, who is on the other end. We can communicate with people on the other side of the planet. And this is part of the transmutation of the human into perfect communication devices, being able to take in a signal coming into us, both from other individuals on this planet, but also from the higher dimensions who are sending us messages and who are guiding us and to tell us what to do, what you need to do next. So just like the meditation technique allowed us to become purified and all the other sacred texts have come in to purify us, now the knowledge book has taken the next step of finishing the process, and by actually following the precepts, following the guidelines being given, we are able to slowly to proceed up the evolutionary path and to be able to purify ourselves to get to the next level and to become genuine humans, and where we can personify and be those individuals who personify the cipher of Mevlana, which is come, come, come. And that is infinite patience, infinite tolerance, and infinite humility. We will eventually realize that we are supreme beings. However, we act with humility. We act with moral code. So right now, the knowledge book is continuing the previous practices. And when the knowledge book says that it is contains all the essence, energies, and frequencies of the previous sacred texts, it becomes very visible when you think about what those sacred texts did and what the knowledge book does. So we still have laws, we still have precepts, we still have guidelines that are given to us, suggestions that are given to us that need to be followed, and they need to be followed exactly for the effect to work, for the technology to work. We still have love. We still have the technique of, instead of reciting mantras, instead of reciting specific practices, we now read the knowledge book, sometimes in silence by ourselves and sometimes at the focal point. When the solar teacher reads the entire fascicle, then that voice brings in those energies and frequencies into that magnetic field, and everyone within that magnetic field benefits, plus it is reflected to the surrounding city. And when there are enough people in the focal point, then we affect the entire city and help the entire city. So if we had a focal point in every city in this country will be transformed. Okay, but now it is time to finish. Just need to remind you, www.usa.theknowledgebook.net and 973-787-7035. And we need to say what Mrs. Chirac often says, you are the ones who will save the world. And hopefully you have a knowledge book and will get a knowledge book, so we'll be able to transmute yourselves into genuine humans and transmit this world and transmute and transform this world into a friendly, happy world. Thank you. And we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek. Marge was led to the Knowledge Book, a gift to humanity, and its time of transition to the Golden Age that provided the truth and energies and frequencies. Now, she shares information from and answers questions about the Knowledge Book with you each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information, visit Marge at usa.theknowledgebook.net.